Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. What is thy name?
My name is Legion, because we are many.
And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. Now there was there nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding, and all the devils besought him, saying,
Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them.
And forthwith Jesus gave them leave, and the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea, and were choked in the sea.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's still October, so of course we are letting out a great demonic oink today. Robert, I know, so you wanted to talk about a demoniac today, and this was a very exciting idea to me, because this story in the Bible about the Gerasene or Gadarene demoniac has long been one of my favorites, but also because it's a story that concerns possessed swine, I think it gives us a great opportunity to talk about pig technology.
Yeah, this is a really fun one, I guess you'd say. This is definitely a section of the New Testament that I remember turning to if I was bored in church growing up, mm-hmm. because it is such a weird little scene. You know, Jesus meeting with an individual that's possessed not by one demon, but by like thousands of demons, a legion of demons. And then negotiating them out of the man. But not only that, sending them then into a whole bunch of pigs,
right.
which subsequently fall off the side of a cliff into the ocean and drown.
Right. And there are plenty of other stories in the New Testament about Jesus doing various healings, doing exorcisms. Mm-hmm. So that happens elsewhere. But it's like the setting and the weird conclusion of the story that make it so memorable, going into the pigs.
Yeah.
So maybe we should look at this story in a little bit of context and then come back to talk about thoughts about its, you know, historical and theological role, and then thoughts about pigs as animals and what a stampede of devilish intelligence they might bring forth. So I guess let's start with the story in the context of the Gospel of Mark. And I think that's a good place to start because pretty much all scholars agree that Mark is the earliest of the four canonical Gospels, since it's clear that the other Gospels used Mark as a source. And like they made variations on it according to their storytelling priorities and probably also from the use of other sources. Now, this story does also appear in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, but with some changes. So in the Gospel of Mark, the story happens in chapter 5, and it's right after a chapter where Jesus is out preaching to a crowd. He tells the crowd a bunch of familiar parables, like the parable of the lamp under the bushel basket and the parable of the mustard seed. You know, if you have faith is only the size of a mustard seed, you can do great things.
Yeah, busting out the greatest hits.
Right. And in the chapters before this in Mark, he's done some various preaching, some healing. I think he heals the paralytic. He heals a man with a withered hand. But so at the end of this, at the fourth chapter, after he's been doing this preaching, Jesus says, okay, let's go across the sea, which is taken to refer to the Sea of Galilee. It's a body of water in the area. So Jesus and the disciples leave behind the crowds. They get in the boat to cross the water. And on the way across, a big storm comes up and the disciples are all shaken in their boots. But then Jesus wakes up and he says, peace, be still. And the storm is replaced with dead calm. And then Jesus goes on to immediately shame his disciples for being afraid, saying, have you still no faith? And they're all, of course, amazed by his powers, saying, who is this then that even the wind and the sea obey him? So I think in the context of the gospel story, this preacher Jesus has been telling parables that show his great wisdom about the coming kingdom of God, and he is showing more and more direct power himself all the time, not just as a teacher, but as possibly some kind of sorcerer or even divine being. And that's when we get to the demoniac here. So they get to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and Mark says it's in the country of the Gerasenes, but other gospels say it's in a different place, the country of the Gadarenes, and that's why there are different names for this story, the Gadarene swine, the Gadarene demoniac, the Gerasene swine, the Gerasene demoniac. But wherever it is, we immediately meet this man out of the tombs.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that you know, the differences in the other two gospels. In Matthew, for instance, it's not one man out of the tomb, but two men out of the tomb.
Yeah.
And then also in Luke, it's one man again, but this time he's also naked, as if to you know, really stress the feral nature of the individual.
Well, yes, and in Luke's telling of the story, that's the one where it's stressed that he was naked before he got the demons cast out, and then he puts on clothes once the demons are out of him.
Right, and then sometimes in like retellings, I've noticed, especially in artistic depictions of this scene, sometimes the artists seem to just pick and choose from all three. You know, so I saw one where it was two naked individuals serving as the men of the tomb.
Oh, this is a very common thing that happens because you've got, you know, different versions of the same story that appear across the four gospels. Sometimes people will just, like, as modern readers, combine them all into one. So mm-hmm. they'll put all the elements there next to each other in ways that don't always make sense, but it can be funny.
So what follows is, yeah, an exorcism scene, you know, one that's maybe not as dramatic as modern horror viewers would, mm-hmm. would hope for. It's a little more of a negotiation in some respects.
Yeah.
But yeah, on the face of it, we have a very disturbed individual who seems to live among the tombs and abuses himself with rocks, like scratching himself up with rocks.
Yeah, we're told he lives in the graveyard, but he spends day and night prowling the graveyard and the mountains, bruising himself with rocks and howling.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when Jesus shows up, right, we get the unclean spirits. Immediately, they start begging Jesus. Like, they recognize his power, which I think is a thing that's supposed to be important in the story.
Yeah, they realize they don't have a lot of bargaining strength here going
right.
into this.
It's like when the bad cop shows up in the interrogation room. They're like, oh, no. Yeah, now we've been getting away with this, but now we're in trouble. And so they immediately beg Jesus not to send them away. They reveal their name, which I think we can come back to that, but that might be a theologically significant thing. They reveal their name is Legion, as in a large Roman military unit consisting of more than 1,000 soldiers. It was different numbers at different times.
Yeah, I was looking at various modern translations, and there's at least one translation that just said, our name is a lot because there are a lot of us.
I mean, I do think that's sort of what it was supposed to mean.
Yeah.
But it
lacks that
right.
the charm, you know? Like, yeah. like, what if it was
our,
the
our
Exorcist?
Name is a whole mess of demons.
Like, what if the film was The Exorcist 3, colon, a lot, instead of yeah. Legion, which of course is referring back to this very line.
Though it might also be significant that Legion is like a Roman concept,
yes.
because of course at the time, like a huge theme of the Gospels is that the people, the Jewish people, are being occupied by the Romans, and there are a lot of sort of rebellious sentiments and anti-Roman ideas.
Yeah. And when we'll definitely come back to some of the Roman elements here.
Yeah. But to conclude the story, of course, this was in the opening passage we read, but Jesus commands the demons out. They ask him to send them into a flock of pigs nearby, and Jesus is like, okay, take the pigs. So he sends them into the pigs, and then the pigs immediately go stampeding down into the water of the Sea of Galilee to their doom. So I see overall that I think this story in its place in the Gospel of Mark is kind of an escalation moment. Like Jesus keeps showing greater and greater power, not just wisdom in teaching, not just power over the winds and the seas, but now even over a legion of demons.
Yeah.
And so all the disciples are, of course, like, oh, wow, how, you know, he's so powerful. They keep emphasizing that this is even more powerful than we thought he was before.
So I was looking around for a little more information on this, and I read Spirit Possession and the Gerasene Demoniac by J. Duncan M. Darrett from the journal Man in 1979.
Uh-huh.
And he made the following points about it. First of all, he points out there are no really important textual variants of the tale.
Uh-huh.
You know, like one man possessed by demons, two naked or not naked, like still the story is essentially the same.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if that also refers to the fact that there are not major like – non-canonical early older texts that have different versions of the story that change.
Yeah, that's
true. Because
that
is the case
yeah.
with some stories.
He also points out that the man here is clearly shunned as unclean, and he's engaging in kind of an out of control cleansing ritual.
Hmm.
You know, the scraping of the body, the abusing of himself with rocks.
That's interesting.
You know, really on those same lines as like flagellation and so forth. Darrett also draws comparisons to various rites of possession in other cultures where sensation to physical pain is dulled, which I think is an interesting point because there are various, like especially religious trials and rituals in which one will do something that is either, you know, definitely painful or takes on the appearance of painful, and just be via the like the frenzy of the of the ritual, one is able to experience less pain, or to or at least it's, you know, you get into that area where it's like there's the experience of the rite, and then there is the story of the rite. You know,
well, yeah, this also makes me think, of course, about the nature of what was going on when people believe they encountered demon possession in
yeah.
the ancient world. I mean, so of course there are multiple theories about this, and it would probably vary from case to case. Of course, one major and pretty obvious thing is the idea that people in the ancient world often didn't understand that they were looking at the symptoms of various mental illnesses and
yeah.
would characterize that as a person being possessed by an unclean spirit. But you could also imagine a person who might not necessarily have a particular mental illness but would be prompted in some various way by the religious context to believe that they were possessed in some way and act out the role.
Yeah, like think of some of the medieval rites of penance that would come much later,
mm-hmm.
In which one would say, for instance, you know, flagellate yourself with sticks or whips, wear ragged clothing and crawl through the streets,
mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. So in all of this, Darrett is saying that this is, you know, potentially essentially a theater of protest that's
mm-hmm.
taking place. You know, that there is a performance quality to it. Of course, and then he points out that, Jesus acquires the demon's name, which is often an important aspect of some sort of an exorcism ritual.
Yeah. I think that even shows up in like the the Conjuring movies, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah. I didn't know if there was a like an actual ancient exorcism precedent for that. But it's in the second Conjuring movie. There's this whole thing where it's like, I figured out the demon's name. Now I can defeat it.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely part of Dungeons and Dragons.
If you
know the demon's name, you have some power over it usually.
From the Gospel of Guy Gax.
Yeah. and then he also points out what we just discussed already. Legion is, of course, a military term. The man is possessed by a host of demons, and Jesus is either speaking to all of them or perhaps to the leader commanding them. And Jesus is presented as being, you know, much more than a match for an entire legion of demons. Like you say, this is a lot of this is about presenting just how powerful Jesus is.
Yes, and I think that's an important point of comparison when even you look at something like in The Exorcist, you know, the priests show up and the demon taunts them and stuff. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm ready to do battle. When Jesus shows up, the demon is immediately crying uncle. He's like, no, no, don't send me out too far. Maybe just let me go to the pigs. Like
right.
he immediately knows he's beaten.
Now, pigs, Derrida reminds us, were slaughtered in offering to the underworld at Roman burials, thus their connection to the tombs and to this particular individual's fascination with morbidity and with death. Pigs are associated with sacrifices to demons as well as with bestiality. And Derrida stresses that there is a sexual connotation to spirit possession. You know, this idea of entering into the pigs, or also just the idea of a spirit having entered into you and taken hold of your senses.
Well, that also makes me think about another possible explanation for a belief in spirit possession in the ancient world, which is just that maybe a person wasn't even necessarily experiencing symptoms of mental illness or even acting out a possession. Maybe they were just behaving in an unconventional way and mm-hmm. people around them said, well, you know, nobody in the right mind would act like that. So if they violated sexual taboos or something like that, you could say they must have had a demon in order to do that.
Now, one thing that he does point out is that pigs are actually great swimmers.
Really?
Yeah. And also that they don't stampede. So there's a big problem with this idea of potentially – it depends how, I guess, you read into the demon possession of the pigs.
Mm-hmm.
But pigs on their own are not going to stampede. They're probably not going to drown in the river. Now, I guess you could say that, well, they're not – they're no longer pig brains controlling those pigs. Those are scared demon brains, and maybe they don't know how to swim, I guess.
Well, this is funny. I was also looking up examples. I was trying to find things about pigs stampeding. I didn't really find anything like good documented like zoological literature about pigs stampeding, though I did find a news story about supposedly somewhere in Syria a stampede of pigs killing some ISIS fighters in recent years. But I think that's probably just like a news – like a journalist's appellation. It might have not have been a stampede, but just like a herd of pigs.
Wasn't there a scene in a Cormac McCarthy novel where a herd of pigs trample off into the river, though? Probably a reference to this very tale. I feel like it was one of the Appalachian books, like maybe Child of God or Outer Dark.
I don't know. I've read some of those books, but I don't remember that scene.
Hmm.
But I could be wrong.
Yeah, and it might not have been pigs. It might have been something else.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of drowned animals at one point, as I recall.
Certainly.
Now, on the uncleanliness of pigs, obviously much has been written about this because there are supposed practical reasons that pork is prohibited in Judaism and Islam. One is that pigs are not very sustainable in drier environments. That's the argument. Another is that pork, of course, can contain trichinosis. But, of course, that's taken care of if it's cooked properly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's often pointed out that like that even when Judaism and Islam or even when these religions travel out of areas where you could make the argument that a pig is not suitable for this environment, like the restriction still remains.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm convinced by any of the alleged practical reasons behind the prohibition on pork and other foods in Judaism and Islam because – I mean, I haven't seen any really convincing evidence there. It seems to be more likely this is another one of the many unique practices and characteristics you'd find in any religion or culture that don't necessarily result from some kind of clear material environmental mandate. I mean, there are some. Like we were just recently talking about, you know, sky burial mm-hmm. practices in Tibet being a religious cultural practice, but perhaps resulting from the fact that also within that landscape, it's hard to find places to dig graves. It's hard to find wood to burn bodies with. So it just sort of makes sense from a material environmental standpoint. I think sometimes explanations like that make sense, but I'm not convinced by any of the pork ones.
Right. Another one that's sometimes brought up, well, in the texts themselves, sometimes a point is made about the cloven hoof, which seems kind of nonsensical.
What's the problem?
Yeah. Then there's also the idea that, well, pigs are omnivores and they may consume scavenged flesh, mm-hmm. and that could be seen as unclean. But as we've discussed in the show before, even strict herbivores will eat meat on occasion.
Right.
I did some searching on this and saw some videos of like how many ducklings can a particular cow eat.
Oh.
That sort of thing. You know, I mean, it just happens.
I've never considered cows before. We thought about like deer eating meat, of course, squirrels eating meat.
But you think, wilder creatures, right?
But this now is just haunting my brain. Why is it so much scarier to be eaten by a cow than any other animal I can think of?
Because you trusted it so much. You thought that you had it bested through domestication.
Seems so docile, and then it jumps 7 feet straight in the air and eats you. Have you ever seen how high cows can jump? It looks wrong.
I don't know that I have. I'm always impressed by how fast a horse can move and how fast it can like plop onto the ground and pop back up again. So let's get back though to the religious reasons, ultimately the social reasons to prohibit something like pork. Mm-hmm. As explained by Nigel Barber, PhD in Psychology Today, the signaling theory of religion puts forth that abstaining from something like pork is a way of signaling your devotion and provides something that a social group can bond over. And you're all going to be paying a ritual cost for this. Basically, food taboos keep co-religionists together, and it's something where like everyone has to give up something. You have to pay a fee to join this club.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Again, I don't know that that's the primary real reason, but that certainly seems very plausible.
Right.
I mean, I think there are all kinds of things that religions do where the main goal of doing them is showing that you are a devoted member of the religion in good standing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like for a modern example, one turns to like the straight edge movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where on one hand, you can say, okay, there is a sort of signaling going on here. People who are abstaining from these various substances are doing so, and by doing so, they can claim to be a part of a particular group. However, it's not the only thing. Like there are also, any individual that's following that lifestyle will also point to other reasons why they are abstaining, not mm-hmm. merely to be a part of a group, but for, various other lifestyle purposes.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, whether or not those other reasons are also truly motivating them, I think it's hard to deny that shared abstinence creates solidarity.
Right. But to come back to the Romans definitely ate pork. And so when the Romans roll in and begin controlling your territory, they're eating the pork. You are not. There's a firm line to be drawn in the sand there between us and them.
Yeah, right. So there could be like people all around with flocks of pigs that they're preparing to eat, and you can look at those things and be like, well, that's no part of my life.
Yeah. And of course, ultimately, rules against eating certain animals are going to be kind of an arbitrary agreement. And I think a huge example of this, as we'll discuss, is the predominant American notion that it's well and good to eat a pig, that eating a pig is something that should be celebrated. We should have parades about it. Mm-hmm. But eating a dog, well, that's just not acceptable. Now, on the nature of exorcism itself, we've covered exorcism on the show before, and I think it's always important, too, to think about rites of exorcism across various cultures as being rites, potentially, too, of expulsion of negative feelings, negative attributes, and in some cases, a crude attempt to treat mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to think about, the tendency to think about exorcism as a pure superstitious rite and, not to think about its connotations to more secular rites, such as expelling negative thoughts via breath and various meditation and yogic practices, I mean, we don't think of that as exorcism. We don't think of that as magic. But it is an exercise that can allow us to allow your fear to pass over and through you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I see no problem at all from a secular standpoint accepting that exorcism could sometimes be a successful psychological intervention, not because there are actually like like spirit demons, but because like going, like you're saying, like going through a cathartic event where you go through some kind of ritual purging. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it's necessarily a reliable practice, but it's not surprising that it might work sometimes.
Yeah, in some cases. And certainly not to say that it is a better method for like for actual mental illness.
Right.
But at any rate, I just want to like provide a frame of reference for it. Mm-hmm. Also, I want to come back to the idea of pig-based beings, pig-based monsters and pig-based creatures. Mm-hmm. You do see these pop up in a lot of different mythologies around the world. Wherever there are pigs, I mean, it's just a given, right? Wherever there are pigs, there is going to be some idea of the pig, half-man, half-pig being.
Man, pig monsters are underrated for horror value.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like sometimes they're rolled out as more comedic relief. And in those cases, I don't think enough enough emphasis is placed on just how horrifying, how scary like a wild boar can be.
I have no respect whatsoever for the Saw movies. That's mm-hmm. just not my kind of horror film. But the one thing I remember thinking was actually successful about them is just the fact that like the creep in them sometimes wears a pig mask.
Oh, yeah. That was one of his many disguises.
Yeah.
A very dramatic individual. He had a mask. He had a puppet.
Uh-huh.
He had a whole production truck.
The puppet's just kind of goofy. The pig mask is where it's at.
Now, I want to make a quick side note about Chinese tradition. You know, in all this talk of demons and pigs, I can't help but think of Pigsy. Are you familiar with Pigsy?
I don't think I know Pigsy.
Pigsy or what is it? Zhu Baojie from Journey into the West.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look up Journey into the West and Pigsy, for instance, on YouTube, you'll find numerous clips, I'm sure, from the various film and TV adaptations of Journey into the West. I mean, there have also been video game adaptations of Journey into the West. But the accounts vary. But basically, he was punished by the Jade Emperor for lusting after Cheng, the goddess of the moon. And his punishment, he's cast down to earth and winds up in the form of a half-pig, half-human monster. But despite his faults, he becomes a great adventurer and is a key character in Journey into the West and ultimately slays many demons.
Oh, a pig slayer? Did we talk about him in our Monster Slayer episode last year?
I don't think we did. I don't think Journey into the West has actually come up on the show before, but there's a lot of wonderful material there if we ever choose to come back to it.
Oh, I guess I got to read it now.
Yeah, or watch it. Like I say, there's some fabulous film adaptations of this. You got the Monkey King, you got Pigsy, the whole crew.
All right, I think we have to take a break, but we will be right back with more about the Gerasene Demoniac, the Gadarene Swine, pig science, and much more.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage.
With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gaginianaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back. So I've already mentioned how this is one of those little Bible stories that if you're bored in a Christian church, you sometimes turn to. Also, it has had a big influence on horror and sort of demonic and occult themed material. Most notably, sure. The Exorcist III: Legion.
A surprisingly good movie, given that The Exorcist 1, of course, horror classic. Mm-hmm. Exorcist 2, one of the most hilarious bad horror movies of all time. I remember it's got a line in it that's something like, "Your machine has scientifically proven there's an ancient demon locked inside her."
Yeah, I think if I had to rewatch an Exorcist film this year, it would be 3. Like 1 is a classic, but also I've always been one that is believed that the best parts of The Exorcist are not the screaming crazy Reagan raging out with demonic possession. It's moments. It's like the little what Pazuzu, the creature that's been made by the child or drawn on a sheet in the background. That sort
sure,
of thing.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I actually think some of the best stuff in The Exorcist is the parts where it's kind of like a 70s character study movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there are parts that almost feel kind of like a Scorsese movie or something, with like Father Karras visiting his mother and that kind of stuff and his horrible nightmares. And I think it's a very effective horror film. But Exorcist 3 is also really, really good. It's been years since I've seen it, but or at least I won't say it's as good as the first one, but it's surprisingly good for being a third film.
Right.
I can't think of a third film that competes apart from Halloween 3.
Ooh, Underworld 3 is the best of the Underworld movies. So there's that.
But the I Am Legion thing shows up in all kinds of just like, demon horror, right? It's mm-hmm. How can you resist? It seems like such an easy thing to pick up and run with. I remembered it also shows up in something that I inexplicably read when I was a kid. I remember buying a used copy of the screenplay or the teleplay to Stephen King's Storm of the Century, which is, I think, not ever a piece of fiction. I think he wrote it directly for like made for TV. Mm-hmm. So I was just reading the original work, which is his teleplay. Not King's best work, but basically the Demon Legion shows up in a small island town in New England, of course, and he demands to steal the town's children. And he's originally disguised as a man named Linoge. And of course, it's an anagram for my name is for Legion, for Iron Legion. But also he's played by – the demon is played by Colm Feore, a prolific character actor and the bad guy from one of your favorites, Robert, Chronicles of Riddick.
Oh, yeah. He's the Lord Marshal, right?
Right, yeah. Is he like – he's like the main big bad in it, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah. He's the head necromonger, yeah. Yeah, and he is a wonderful character actor. He's been in tons of things. Great comedic actor as well. Now, in any given like piece of a religious text. Mm-hmm. There, you know, there's always various things going on with it, right? There's the question of what does it say? What is the story? What did the people who wrote it or told it or transcribed it mean for it to say? Mm-hmm. And then what is the tradition of using it? How has it been used and even misused over the years to drive home particular points?
Right. Often what did the author intend for it to mean versus how has it been interpreted by the faithful over the years is a very different thing.
Yeah, and one interpretation of this text I was surprised by was the fact that it's been this been used to drive home this idea that humans have no responsibility towards animals, particularly suggested by St. Augustine of Hippo. Mm-hmm. Augustine wrote, quote, "Christ himself shows that to refrain from the killing of animals and the destroying of plants is the height of superstition. For judging that there are no common rights between us and the beasts and trees, he sent the devils into a herd of swine and with a curse withered the tree on which he found no fruit."
Oh, yeah. That's the withering of the fig tree, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is a different story in the Bible. Jesus comes across a fig tree. It says there were no figs on the tree, for figs were not in season. And Jesus becomes angry with the tree and he withers it.
Yeah. I mean, he was having a bad day that day, probably.
Well, I think that story, to go back to what authors actually intended versus how they're interpreted, I think a lot of scholars think that that story was originally meant to be like a metaphor for people who did not bear good fruits, mm-hmm. right? So it's not literally about trees.
Or showing off his abilities to wither fruit.
Right. At least under this interpretation. That seems a very plausible interpretation to me. But here Augustine's running with it and is like, no, it's literally about trees. It's about how trees, not worth nothing. You can do whatever you want to them. It doesn't matter. Jesus showed it in this parable.
Yeah.
Not parable, scene. Yeah.
You can well imagine that like Augustine like was kicking a pig or something or a dog and someone said, hey, don't kick that dog. And he's like, well, Jesus put a whole bunch of demons in pigs and drove them off a cliff. So I have free reign to kick as many dogs and pigs as I see fit.
Somebody shamed him for letting his orchard wither, and then he's like, I'll show you. And he goes and looks up the Bible. He's like, hey, look right here.
So various authors have taken issue with Augustine's interpretation here. Christian vegetarian and Anglican priest Andrew Lindsay, author of Christianity and the Rights of Animals, he counter-argues and says, you know, this is ridiculous. It is just propping up Augustine's prior opinion that animals have no rights. And he contends that the demons ultimately, they're selecting their own vessel here and did so because they were weaker creatures. And obviously the demons themselves don't care for animal rights. Meanwhile, he argues that there are plenty of other passages where it's far easier to read pro-animal ideas in the words of Christ than it is to shoehorn in an anti-animal rights agenda.
Well, there is one thing that I actually do wonder about the story that's very interesting. Is there supposed to be some kind of metaphorical or theological meaning to the fact that the pigs – so Jesus sends the demons into the pigs where they ask to go. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, you can go into the pigs. And then they go into the pigs and then the pigs immediately stampede and die. Why do they stampede and die? Was that just added to the story because like, oh, okay, you know, that'd be an interesting way to conclude it. Mm-hmm. Now the demons are dealt with. Or was there some like meaning there? Like does this have something to do with the Romans or with, you know?
Yeah, because we already touched on the connection between the Romans and pigs. We touched on the connection between pigs and the location with the tombs. Mm-hmm. So and then also you always have to wonder too with stories like this, like what other, you know, pre-existing narratives were there out there that have potentially been otherwise lost that are reflected in this story.
Sure.
Now, Thomas Aquinas apparently, I read, thought that this passage showed that Christ was primarily concerned with men rather than pigs. I've seen that pointed out a few different places. But I was looking for like a direct quote on this, uh-huh. and I was looking at Aquinas' thoughts on the passage. And most of it seemed to come down to him stressing the fact that the pigs were unclean. So, of course, that's the best place to send a bunch of demons. They love unclean things. Hmm. And it also shows, he argued, that the devil can't kill you unless you present yourself as an unclean animal. But I don't know. There's a lot of riffing on the scripture that I ran across, but I'm not sure animal rights or the lack thereof was the primary concern.
Well, while we're on the subject of the demonic oink, I think this is a great opportunity to jump over to talking a little bit about pig intelligence, pig behavior, and even a very recent discovery about possible pig tool use.
Yeah, yeah, that was I think ultimately the bit of news that, that made up my mind on pursuing this as a topic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we've touched on animal rights, we've touched on the notion of higher intelligence in the form of demons being dropped into the bodies of pigs, plus the notion that in some traditions, Pigsy from Journey into the West is a product of reincarnation.
Hmm.
So having touched on these notions, yeah, we'll come back around to the question, well, how smart is just a normal pig? You know, certainly I think we can assume its brain is not on par with a human's. I mean, we can more than assume that. We can state that. But they're not the dumb animals we sometimes take them for,
mm-hmm.
The sort of comic relief, look how dumb the pig is. It's covered in mud. It lives in a pig pen.
Well, I don't know if this is actually a good explanation, but at least something I've heard postulated in the past is – what if the common prohibitions on eating pigs in some religions stem from not the uncleanness of pigs but the similarity between pigs and humans?
Mm.
I mean, there are a lot of sort of biological and morphological similarities. For example, some pigs having like fairly bare skin, kind of like less hair than most mammals have, unlike kind of like their human cousins, apparently human meat tasting kind of like pork, apparently.
I've also noticed that when a pig is butchered, sometimes its body looks like that of a human. Particularly if you watch a lot of like cooking shows on various streaming channels, and inevitably there'll be a scene where someone has they're rolling out the slaughtered pig, and it's been prepared for the barbecue grill, and it looks alarmingly like a small person.
Yeah, and so again, I don't know if that really has all that much explanatory power, but I can see that a little bit. Like maybe we anthropomorphize pigs because it's just already pretty close. There's a natural leap from humans to pigs.
And boy, do we – I mean, this has always disturbed me. The level to which a barbecue restaurant will anthropomorphize a pig, usually on the logo, where it'll be, it'll be like smiling, happy humanoid pigs roaming around or even doing grisly things like cooking themselves or climbing into grills. It's like, what are you doing? Shouldn't you be like distancing yourself from this notion that the pigs are rational beings and you are eating them?
Well, it makes me think of the Chick-fil-A marketing strategy where they would have the cows painting the signs.
Oh, yeah. It's brilliant, really. Anthropomorphize the other animal.
Right.
That was, I think, a wise choice. So I was looking around a little bit just on sort of pre-existing knowledge about the intelligence of pigs because there's been a lot of data on this. So Barry Estabrook wrote a book called Pig Tales, which gets into all of this. He's a science writer, and he points out some of the big key points about pig behavior. First of all, pigs have been taught to play computer games.
Okay.
And this gets to the fact that pigs have proven themselves to be very good at learning new tasks, learning new tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Which is essentially what's going on when they're playing a computer game in some of these experiments.
They're trainable.
Yeah. Pigs have a sense of self, and they can recognize themselves in mirrors.
Really?
Yeah. They can also figure out how a mirror works. Not in terms of like how is it made and how it's like how the optics of it. Mm-hmm. But, they can figure out what they're seeing through it and use it to identify food.
Oh, really? So they can recognize that the mirror is a reflection of what's behind them and stuff.
Yeah. And also pigs can look at another pig and calculate what that pig might do or how it might act. A 2016 University of Lincoln study found that, as with humans, a pig's judgment and decisions are governed by mood and personality type. They're also proven to be really good at remembering where food stores are. And not only that, how they rate in size to each other. So it's not just a matter of like, oh, there's some the researchers put so much food, put food here and here and here. No, they can remember the proportions as well.
Mm.
They can rank them in their heads. And they're also really good at deceiving each other when it comes to food.
Oh, how does that work?
Basically, it comes down to the fact that they're intelligent animals, but they're also highly social animals.
Mm-hmm.
They in the wild, wild hogs are not living in seclusion. They're living in contact with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So they are social creatures.
And on the subject of domestication, the domesticated pig diverged from wild hogs somewhere like 8,000 years ago. That's when we began domesticating pigs. And it is kind of impressive that we haven't managed to domesticate the smarts out of them. Like they're like even the domesticated pig is an intelligent creature.
Well, maybe we should explore more of that intelligence after we come back from a break and we can talk about pigs and tool use. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So tool use. This is really fascinating because, of course, tool use is our thing, the humans. Tools are the things we use to build our barbecue restaurants and to slaughter pigs and then to cook pigs and serve pigs and then to eat pigs.
But apparently it takes no tools to cast demons from a human into pigs.
Oh, that's right.
We're not told there's a wand involved or anything. So yeah, Robert, I found out about this interesting report on pig intelligence recently, I think because you shared it with me.
The day it came out, I shared it with our Facebook group, The Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a discussion module, which is a place you can go if you want to discuss episodes of the show and sort of related studies with other listeners.
So for some background, talking about tool use is often taken, of course, as one of the most interesting, most important signs of higher intelligence in animals. It's I think, fairly plausibly argued to be one of the main things that makes humans very special, right? We've got language, we've got tool use, right? But we're not the only animals that use tools. A few non-human animals show pretty clear, undisputed use of tools. Of course, one great example is other primates, right? Like chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, and even, I think, gorillas and some monkeys and stuff. Chimpanzees will sometimes like use large rocks to crush nutshells. Use sticks for hunting or for fishing insects or other prey out of crevices and enclosures. We've also extensively covered tool use in some bird species in the past. If you want to learn more, you can check out our older episodes on the unsettling depths of bird intelligence, I think it was called.
Yes.
The primary examples here are birds like corvids and parrots. A great example is the New Caledonian crow, which has been involved in a lot of research. They can use sticks or bark for rooting around inside crevices, fishing for insects and larvae, sometimes even displaying really startling levels of abstraction. I believe there are examples of them constructing tools, like putting things together to make tools, or using one tool not to get food but to access a second better tool which can be used to get food. I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, there are other marine mammals like cetaceans also sometimes display behaviors that might count as tool use. I think you've mentioned before dolphins like using sponges as tools.
Yes. Yeah, that definitely comes up.
What was the deal? It's basically like for seafloor foraging.
I believe so. I'm a little foggy on the details of that one, but there is there's definitely a case that has been made for tool use by dolphins. Uh-huh. Yes,
even the octopus actually. That's mm-hmm. invertebrate tool use. The octopus, for example, will sometimes carry shells or like coconut shells with them to fold over their bodies to use as shelter, or armor, or a hunting blind. And then there are more arguable examples of things that might or might not be tool use depending on your criteria. I mean, if you really stretch it, like sometimes even reptiles like crocodilians are alleged to use tools. But I think not everyone would agree on whether these behaviors count. But maybe the newest, most surprising discovery of animal tool use as of the day we're recording this is this very recent documentation of tool use by pigs. So what would count as tool use? Well, I was reading a great article about this new discovery in Nat Geo by Christine Delamore. I think this is the best article I've found about this new research. And she cites a definition here which seems very reasonable to me. So the definition of tool use here is, quote, "the exertion of control over a freely manipulable external object," which is the tool, "with the goal of altering the physical properties of another object, substance, surface, or medium via a dynamic mechanical interaction, or two, mediating the flow of information," mm-hmm. Which sounds a little complicated, but basically it means you got to use an object that's not part of your body, an object from the outside, to make changes to your environment or objects in your environment, or to control information somehow. Now, if you're wondering, like, how can information work? I believe that would mean, for example, by changing what can be seen and by whom. So if you use an object to help you see something you couldn't otherwise see, or to keep somebody else from seeing something, like you put up something to hide yourself, that could be considered tool use.
Right. So, yeah, like, so the idea of, say, the octopus climbing inside of a coconut is arguably an example of this.
Right. And I think, though, there would be differences between like going into a hole is not tool use. Mm. So you could be hiding there. I think it would be like if you carry along a thing with you that you can hide inside.
Right.
But then even then you run into some difficulties. I mean, when you see an octopus doing that, that seems like tool use. But when a hermit crab does it, that doesn't seem like tool use. Right. So they're like, there are always going to be these difficulties with these edge cases about what counts and what doesn't. So there's a lot of arguing, I think, in the scientific literature about does this case count or does it not count and why. But anyway, this new research about pig tool use originates with a conservation ecologist named Meredith Root Bernstein, who in October of 2015 was at a zoo in Paris. She was observing a group of Visayan warty pigs at this Parisian zoo. And Visayan warty pigs are a critically endangered species of wild pig native to the Philippines. They're critically endangered, like so many other creatures, because of habitat destruction. It's the ruin of their natural rainforest homeland that has driven them to this point. You may have actually seen images of them. The males of the species often have a natural mohawk hair hairdo running down the length of their bodies. So they look pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. They look pretty rough and tumble.
This group observed by Root Bernstein, they were in captivity. And that's important to remember because that can sometimes change animal behavior. I've got an image, by the way, for you to look at here, Robert. The hair is mighty.
Absolutely. I would go as far as to say that this particular hog looks rad.
This hog could play some kind of minor tough in a Russell Mulcahy movie.
Yeah.
So in October 15, Ruth Bernstein, she was at the zoo and she noticed one of the pigs in this enclosure picking up a piece of tree bark with its mouth and then using the bark as a spade to dig around in the soil within its enclosure. The pig was named Priscilla, by the way, and Priscilla's mate was named Billy. So the French are good at naming pigs. Actually, I don't know if the French named them, but Priscilla and Billy. And then, of course, there were younger pigs in the enclosure too. But Ruth Bernstein, so she saw this happening, the pig picking up the bark with its mouth and digging with it. And she'd never heard of documented tool use in any species of pig. So she went home to look it up and she couldn't find anything in the animal behavior literature. So she kept returning to the zoo and documenting the pig's behavior with the help of colleagues. But for several months, she never saw it happen again. So what was going on here? Well, Delamore writes that Ruth Bernstein suspected that the digging behavior was part of the pig's nest building process. Mm. And of course, nest building doesn't happen year round. It's not all the time. It's whenever there is a new litter of piglets coming. And this happens about twice a year. So Ruth Bernstein and her colleagues waited. And in the following spring, they did in fact observe tool use yet again. Three of the four pigs in the enclosure were using bark to help dig out their nests, bark or sticks. So does digging with bark count as tool use? We can look in more detail in a minute, but yes, I think it meets the regular criteria, right? It's using an object outside the body, a freely manipulable object to change the environment. And there's no doubt that they're doing it. There's video you can watch online, though they do seem a little clumsy at it. They don't look like hyper like dexterous tool users. Mm-hmm. It's more kind of like – they're flipping the stick all over the place and it kind of moves the dirt around, which does make me wonder, what did tool use look like when like our ancestors first started doing it? It's just like, you know, wildly swinging things around and occasionally getting some benefit out of it.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of us probably fit that description when we use, a particular utensil or go after a particular task in the kitchen that we don't normally do.
Sure.
Like I was grating a sweet potato last night and I feel like that was basically what was happening. People who were observing it might think, wow, this ape can barely manipulate this tool.
I don't know if this counts as tool using intelligence.
Yes, is it tool using intelligence or is it just occasionally rubbing and fumbling this piece of the metal against this tuber? We're not sure.
Robert, are your knuckles okay? Did you lose any knuckles?
No. Luckily, my knuckles, my skin, that's all fine. But that potato did suffer.
Oof, I have lost a knuckle or two to the grater before.
But my point being, you don't have to be an artful user of a tool to be a tool user.
Right. That's exactly right. So Ruth Bernstein and her co-authors published their research in the journal Mammalian Biology in September 2019. And so all the authors were Meredith Ruth Bernstein, Trupti Narayan, Lucille Cornier, and Audi Bourgeois. The article was called Context-Specific Tool Use in Sus Sebifrons in Mammalian Biology, this was published just in September in 2019. So specifically, what's going on with the digging process here? Well, things become kind of interesting. So the authors documented pigs using tools to dig four times in 2016 and seven times in 2017. And it seems that the tool use always came in the middle of the nest digging process. Ultimately, of course, the nest they're producing is going to be like a little dugout pit and it's going to be lined with leaves and that's where the piglets go. They also observed that the male pig's digging was clumsier and less productive than the digging by the females. It also seemed that the knowledge about how to use the digging implements was being passed on both vertically from mother to offspring and horizontally by being taught to the males by the females.
Huh, interesting.
They also introduced foreign objects into the enclosure, like they put spatulas in there to see if the pigs would try to use them. Apparently, they did sort of a couple of times, but they seemed to prefer the sticks and the bark.
Yeah.
I mean, a spatula seems like it would not be the best tool anyway for that task.
Oh, I don't know. You could dig in loose soil okay with a spatula.
Yeah, okay. But like a metal spoon would be better.
Yeah, but biting on a metal spoon might hurt.
That's true.
I mean, using their mouth.
Yeah, we're still giving them a human tool. Mm-hmm. And this is a creature that is using a tool in a different manner. Yeah.
We need to make special pig digging mecha suits, and then we'll really see how far their tool using intelligence goes. But the authors argued that the observed behaviors do meet the best definition of tool use, and I want to read a quote about how they explain this. They say it is tool use, quote, because it involved the manipulation of an external object, the bark, the stick, or the spatula. It occurred exclusively and regularly within a goal-oriented repeated action pattern. Okay, so it's not just like they're running around with sticks in their mouths all the time and occasionally it moves some soil. It only happens sometimes and only when they're digging nests. And to continue with their quote, they say, and as its end result, it altered both the distribution of the soil to make a pit and the physical properties of the tool user, a physical disposition digging action. And thus, it likely also included information transfer to the tool user in the form of proprioceptive feedback different to that without tool use. So there's an information thing again, like using the stick to have a different method of like feeling how deep the hole is and stuff. So one question is, how has this behavior escaped attention so long? In Delamore's article, she mentions that, well, wild pigs are sometimes understudied, so maybe that's the case. Mm. But also, you know, one thing to think about is these pigs are in captivity. Animals in captivity also sometimes show behaviors that the same animals do not exhibit in the wild. But then again, it seemed like the bark was only used for digging nests and only at a specific stage in the nest building process, which makes it pretty different from most of the repetitive, compulsive types of behaviors that you would see induced by captivity.
Right. Yeah. It's not a situation where these pigs were doing this all the time. They were only doing it like every 6 months during their nest building activities.
Right. It's not the panther pacing in its cage in a way that it would not pace in the wild. So the question is, do we find examples of these endangered pigs or other related pigs using tools in the wild? I think this is the first really documented case that's clear, but in her article, Delamore notes an interesting anecdote from somebody she talks to, somebody named Fernando Dino Gutierrez, who is president of the Philippine conservation group known as the Talarak Foundation. And so here's this story, quoting from Delamore's article, quote, a few years ago, Gutierrez witnessed a group of wild pigs pushing rocks toward an electric fence to test it. And Gutierrez says, as soon as they push and the rocks make contact, they would wait for the clicking sound or absence thereof. Clicking means the wires are hot and they will back off and not cross. No sounds mean it is safe to investigate what's beyond the wire. So that seems like pigs using – like possible edge case there of pigs using tools to mediate the flow of information.
Clever girl.
They were testing the fences systematically for weaknesses.
Absolutely.
They remember. But as for whether these specific pigs, the Visayan warty pigs, do this kind of thing in the wild, I think we don't really know. Of course, there aren't many of them in the wild. I think there might just be a few hundred. Their numbers are not really known. But wild pig scientists of the world, combine your powers. Figure this out. Plunge the depths of pig technology.
Yeah, it would be wonderful to hear more about this and certainly to hear about how it's occurring in the wild.
Now, there's one last thing, though, that makes this even more interesting. It's not clear to Ruth Bernstein and her co-authors that the bark or the stick provides much of a utilitarian advantage, if any. According to the study, it seemed digging with the stick was sometimes less efficient than digging with the hooves or with the snout, which is, of course, what they would normally use, I think. So if – and again, you can see this. If you watch the video, the digging does sort of work, but it also looks kind of bumbling and funny, and you can imagine that digging with the snout or the hooves would actually be pretty quick. So if the bark isn't necessarily speeding up the digging process – even though it is working, if it's not making the process faster or more efficient, why do it at all?
Hmm.
One thing that occurred to me is, well, maybe the snout gets sore. I mean, that could be a thing.
Yeah, that's one possibility. One also wonders, of course, if there is something communicated through the act of using the tool, if it's some sort of physical, mental fitness communication.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So this could be tool use that actually, even though it's tool use, doesn't exist primarily for utilitarian advantage. What if this is just a learned animal cultural behavior? Sometimes animals do just pick up and repeat behaviors from one another, even though they don't provide an obvious continuing material benefit. Of course, we can imagine that the brain must be supplying some kind of internal reward that motivates the pig's behavior. But of course, you know, we know from our own experience that we do behaviors all the time that don't provide a clear evolutionary utilitarian benefit. They're just sort of like a cultural artifact. It's something, a behavior popped up. It gets rewarded for some reason in our brains, even though it's not helping us like live longer, be stronger, or reproduce more.
Well, and then via culture, there are various specific tools that we continue to use despite the fact that there are much better ways to go about a particular task. The main idea that – the main example that comes to my mind is the wooden honey ladle implement.
Oh yeah,
we've talked about this on the show before.
Oh, yeah.
About how it's a messy, unnecessary thing that looks cool.
People
like the way it looks, but the honey bear, the squeezable honey bear, is by far the superior means of putting honey on anything or in anything.
But what if these pigs are using the sticks to dig for the same reason that you might use the wooden honey spoon thing? I don't even know what you call that.
I think it has a name, and we're forgetting it once more.
The honey knob.
The honey knob.
The ridged honey knob. Even though, the squeeze bear that you just squeeze with your own hands is more efficient. But why?
Now, another possibility that comes to mind here too is so we're looking to learn more about the wild implementation of this tool use.
Yeah.
So one question I would have is, okay, in the wild, are they using the same pieces of wood, the same pieces of bark, or are they comparable? And if they're not, that could be an issue, right? Maybe they're using a different type of wood in the wild.
That's true. Yeah, maybe this is a behavior that the they're trying to use tools that are the inferior versions of the tool that would be in their native range.
Right. Or then also they're threatened by habitat loss. So maybe they don't even in the wild have the same access anymore, and they're making do with inferior tools to carry out this this practice that they've been doing for so long.
It's like after a nuclear apocalypse, finding humans making phone calls with tin cans and string. You know, it's like, why are they doing that? The tin cans and string don't work all that well, but it's because they're so used to doing the regular phone calls and they don't have the right tools anymore.
Oh man, can you imagine a post-apocalyptic world in which there are no more smartphones, but people still use like little chunks of stone or wood as if they were smartphones. They're essentially like little idols, little wooden gods that they speak to and listen to.
Yes, they carry around little rectangular flints that they stare at while they're out in public. And then if they see somebody they don't want to talk to, they can pretend to be doing something on their flint and then, so they don't have to look up and make eye contact.
Yeah.
Well, to bring it back to the Gadarene swine, it makes me think about how, in a way, a lot of our culturally learned behaviors are kind of like a weird little demon possession, right? They're a thing that gets in our brain and exists for its own sake, even though it doesn't necessarily help us in any way. We just keep doing it. You know, it's like it's the self-rewarding subroutine.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So there you have it. I feel like we covered a lot of ground in this episode, you know? if you're playing the Stuff to Blow Your Mind drinking game, I guess, you got to take multiple shots here. We managed to fit a Bible story in there. We had a skit with demons in it. We got into tool use and animal intelligence, a little bit of Chinese mythology incorporated as well.
That's a lot of my favorite stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all ultimately a Halloween episode because at the heart, we're still dealing with the story of exorcism.
So I'm looking up anagrams for Legion, like Linoge in the Stephen King story. There are really not very many good ones. We got Leg Ion.
Okay, Leg Ion.
That's not really
not
an anagram.
Not as good, but still good.
That just inserts the space. But we also got Ogle In.
Ogle In sounds good.
Ego Nil.
Yeah, I like that one.
Lean Go.
Yeah.
Line Go. And Old Jin.
Old Jin. Well, those demons are going to need a lot of names because there are a lot of them.
I think we must end there.
All right. Well, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, go forth and do so. You'll find them wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever you get your podcasts, just make sure you rate and review. Make sure you've subscribed. That's a great way to support the show. You can also get us find our episodes at stuffblowyourmind.com. Also, we have another show called Invention that we highly recommend you check out. This month, we have a number of episodes that have come out about caskets, casket science, casket history, weird caskets. Casket inventions, well worth listening to if you're in the mood for more seasonal content.
Yeah, if you're not subscribed to Invention, go subscribe now. Ogle in. Big thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, come on and ogle on in at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.